This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Lois Rudnick and Jonathan Richards. Lois Rudnick is a cultural historian and author. Jonathan Richards is an actor and political cartoonist and writer. The two of them have collaborated on a performance that is happening on Sunday, the 31st of January, here at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts. It's called Ever the Twain, William Shakespeare in Mark Twain's America. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
So let's talk about this play that the two of you wrote based on, well, William Shakespeare and Mark Twain. How did the idea come about for creating the show, and how did the collaboration between the two of you come about?
Well, I guess I should start since it was my idea. The idea came to me when I was teaching a course for Renaissance, a lifelong learning institute, on the late dark Mark Twain. Twain has been a passion of mine since I was 16, and my dad introduced me to his scurrilous Letters from the Earth, which is Satan's diaries of his time in the Garden of Eden. And I taught a course on Twain for many years. And I knew that Twain, from the time that he was born, felt rivalry with Shakespeare, because Shakespeare was, without any match, the single most popular, well-known, and well-quoted English writer in the United States in the 19th century. So I came to class one day with an idea of putting them both on the stage and working with this rivalry in some way to sort of explore the reasons why he was so popular, and to bring these two wits together who were just unparalleled. And I met with John Andrews, who's a member of the board of KSFR, for which this performance is a fundraiser. And John, who's a Shakespeare scholar, said he liked the idea and he would introduce me to John Richards. And if John liked the idea, it could go from there. And I'll let you take it from there.
Well, what we began with was what Lois had put together was filled with fascinating material, but we came to realize as we began reading through it that it didn't really have a stage presentation punch. It was more academic than theatrical at that point. So Lois asked me if I would run it through the typewriter, so to speak, and that was how the collaboration worked. I would show her what I was doing, she'd make suggestions, and we turned it into what would be a rollickingly entertaining evening at the Lenzic on January 31st.
I love the phrase, running it through the typewriter. It's sort of old-fashioned.
A little old-fashioned, yes.
But what it means is applying your creative process.
Right.
And so let's talk about the things that Mark Twain and William Shakespeare have in common, which it turns out to be a lot more than any of our listeners, and certainly me as a reader, might have ever guessed.
Yes.
Well, one thing that's kind of interesting, because one of the things that will come out during the course of this evening, is that Mark Twain was among the early proponents of the theory that Shakespeare did not write Shakespeare, that his candidate and the leading candidate in the mid-19th century America was Sir Francis Bacon. And it's interesting because of the similarities, as you say, between Twain and Shakespeare. They were both poor kids who had a very limited education, left school both at just about the same age, right around 13, and were autodidacts and self-educated beyond that. So Twain's insistence that a rube like Shakespeare with a limited education could not have written the works of Shakespeare is a bit ironic, considering his own background.
Yeah, although I have to say I was wondering about that and thinking about it as I was reading the play, because it is conceivable that, I mean, in this democracy, which was founded during a period and based on the idea that all men were created equal, it's not really comparable to Elizabethan England. I mean, somebody can be an autodidact in 19th or 20th century America in a way that I wonder whether that was possible in Elizabethan England.
Well, you had to be there, I guess.
And Shakespeare clearly was unbelievably well-read. He's, you know, I think most people of his class had very limited public school education, but it was perfectly possible for someone like him to read and
I mean, were there public widely. Libraries?
How? I don't think there were public libraries.
No, I don't think there were public libraries. But Shakespeare came up to London pretty young, and who knows who he was exposed to? And you know, again, we can't really know because there is really very little information about Shakespeare's biography. You know,
and as we will see, Mark Twain makes the acerbic comment that the two least well-known characters in the world are William Shakespeare and Satan.
Right. Satan plays quite a role
in
this play.
Yes, he does.
Which we will leave some of it to our listeners to discover
if they go.
But another thing they had in common now, is it true that they were like eighth cousins?
Eighth time
well,
removed?
Well, almost everybody is eighth cousins. If you start looking up these connections on the internet, you can find Mary Baker Eddy is related to Genghis Khan, probably.
Yes.
So
he just made that up.
I did. I made that up. It's true. I was searching for a far-fetched example, but you can also find, if you research this, we found two different versions, one showing them as Shakespeare and Twain as eighth cousins and one as fifth cousins, but we were already committed to the eighth cousins. So
that may or may not have anything to do with anything, but what we do know for sure is that Twain admired Shakespeare tremendously, mm-hmm. read Shakespeare. How do you see Shakespeare's influence in Mark Twain's work?
Well, it's everywhere. There are works that Twain wrote solely about Shakespeare, like his diatribe, Is Shakespeare Dead?, a pamphlet in which he tries to prove that Sir Francis Bacon was indeed the real Shakespeare. He also wrote a closet drama that much of which is really not for family ears, set in the Elizabethan Tudor times, in which the Queen and several of her courtiers speak extremely frankly about bodily fluids, sexual relationships, in what I've been told by John Andrews is quite good Elizabethan English, and we will have a hilarious excerpt from that closet drama in the play, the part that is publicly, that we can produce for the public.
The piece is called 1601.
Tudor fireside conversation. But Twain also bodlerized, parodied Shakespeare's works, most notably in Huckleberry Finn, where he has his con artists, the Duke and the Dauphin, who are racing down the Mississippi River and appropriate the raft that Huck Finn and Jim, the slave he's trying to help stay free, who has fled his mistress, are on, and perform bodlerized and botched Shakespeare.
Bodlerized?
It means making his high language sound ludicrous and ridiculous. So, for example, there's a speech that the Duke teaches the king, in which he brings together a little bit of King Lear, a little bit of Hamlet, a little bit of Macbeth, some English poetry from the 18th century.
Right.
It is absolutely hysterical.
Pastiche.
A pastiche that sort of undercuts the high language of Shakespeare. But Shakespeare in the 19th century in America, which most of us don't know in this country, was read by, recited by, and loved and cherished by people from madams of whorehouses to frontier men like Jim Bridger. Jim Bridger, who you discovered, who's a character in the new movie Revenant. He was a frontier scout.
He was a trapper and scout, and he was illiterate, but he loved Shakespeare, and he got people to recite it to him so he could learn speeches by heart, and he would declaim soliloquies around the campfire.
Yeah. Amazing. One forgets that 19th century Americans were highly literate in a way that, I mean, we're not even close to that literate now. One-room schoolhouses were more effective than all this, kind of high-tech learning we think we might be doing now.
And Shakespeare was available and not considered to be the kind of purview only of the wealthy educated. That started as a result of one of the most interesting moments in our play, which I will just say took place in 1849 in New York. It was the first police riot, and the police riot happened because of Shakespeare.
Well,
go into that a little bit, because that's an important moment in history, which most people have never heard of.
Well, it was the deadliest riot in New York City history at the time, and it involved the militia firing into the crowd, and people were killed. But it all came about because of a rivalry that developed between two great Shakespearean interpreters, two great Shakespearean actors of the time. One was William Charles MacReady, who was sort of the John Gielgud of his day, the British Shakespearean star. And America had never produced anybody in that area before, but Edwin Forrest was American, born and bred, and sort of the muscular American New World Shakespearean star, and he had great flair and power and whatnot. And he and MacReady were friends for a while, but the friendship sort of devolved into they were friendly rivals that devolved into more bitter rivals. But the American hoi polloi of New York, the
common people,
the man on the street, rallied behind Forrest in a way that people rally behind football teams. This was their champion. He was the star of the people, the American star. And when MacReady came to New York to perform in what we like to refer to as the Scottish play, because, well, we're not in a theater. We can say Macbeth.
We can say Macbeth here, but not in the theater.
What is that? Hang on. Just as an aside.
Nobody. I don't know.
There's a superstition that you can't say the word Macbeth in a theater?
Right. Yes, it's considered the worst kind of bad luck to say the word Macbeth in a theater. So theater people archly say the Scottish play.
Uh-huh.
And that we have some fun with that in this this performance.
But anyway, back to MacReady.
So back to the what is known as the Shakespeare riots, or the Astor Place riots, happened when MacReady was appearing at the posh Astor Place Theater in New York in Macbeth, and a few blocks away, Forrest was also appearing in a production, his own production of Macbeth, and a mob stormed the Astor Place Theater and, broke up the performance. And
why? I mean, there are two productions of Macbeth.
But one of them was it was like the Boston, the New England Patriots were playing in the Astor Place Theater, and the New York Jets were playing at the theater down the way.
It was more than that, though. The Astor Theater was the first theater in New York built solely for the rich. And the poor, who believed that Shakespeare belonged to them, did not like this, and a lot of the hoi polloi that John's talking about were Irish immigrants, loathed and despised by the Anglo upper classes of New York, who saw this as really a kind of anti-English, we're going to assert our Americanness by supporting the American, the great natural-born actor from America, Edwin Forrest. So it was class, it was ethnicity, it was religion, all combined, and jingoism. You know, it's hard to imagine a time when the United States didn't think it was the best at everything, as our president recently told us in his State of the Union address, true or not. But in the 19th century, when foreign visitors came to the United States, especially English foreign visitors like Charles Dickens, they said, we had lots of nature, but we had no culture. We were crude, disgusting, barbarous, uncivilized people who spit everywhere. And there will be a spitting moment in the play to show that they were quite correct.
I was in front of the Albertsons yesterday, and a man spit twice. And it was, you know, how different are we today?
We used to have spittoons. Not that people necessarily use them.
And on that note, so this is all Shakespeare and Twain, and what you set up in this play. We're talking to Jonathan Richards and Lois Rudnick about the play Ever the Twain, William Shakespeare and Mark Twain in America. And what you set up are these great situations where, for example, Mark Twain is reading from his work that's influenced by Elizabethan English or by Shakespeare, and then Shakespeare gets to react.
Right.
Yes. Now, it's a sort of a one-sided rivalry, because Twain obviously had a lot more knowledge of Shakespeare than Shakespeare of Twain, but we bring them back from wherever it is that good writers go.
And we leave that unclear for very good reason.
But But we bring them back to give them a chance to, you know, get together and talk about the things they have in common and the things that set them against each other. And it's all good-natured, but in the course of it, we're able to bring out a lot of quite wonderful stuff. For instance, a lot of people probably are not familiar with Twain's diaries of Adam and Eve. They were actually written separately and later published, later merged together and published. But we have some very sweet, romantic, probably some of the only romantic material that Twain wrote. And then we balance that with some of Shakespeare's romantic writing. Although, not again, even there, we're going for his comic romantic writing.
Yes.
But so we show a balance between the two. I think probably there would be very little difference of opinion that Shakespeare is the greater writer of world renown. But in terms of American comic writing, there's probably nobody who stands above Mark Twain. So he has his place in that pantheon. Right.
And not just the kind of ha-ha, funny, satirical, parodic kind of comedy we associate with King Arthur's Court, Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, or Huck Finn, but also his later writings, which I am particularly attracted to. He was, in my mind, the single greatest anti-imperialist writer in the history of American literature. And the work he wrote about the what we did in the Philippines, the Spanish-American War, his piece, The United States of Lynchardom, absolutely extraordinary material at a time when, you know, very few authors made front page. But if Mark Twain wanted to comment on political events throughout the world, and he saw them firsthand because he had to travel throughout the world to make up all the money he lost in his bad business ventures, he was absolute great copy. He really was our first international literary star in U.S. literary history.
Let's talk about a little bit more about the writing process. I mean, not only do you quote Shakespeare and Twain quite a lot, which is wonderful, but you have to also kind of recreate their speech patterns to be put in the mouths of the actors, of which you, Jonathan, are playing Shakespeare and Bob Martin is playing Mark Twain.
Correct.
And they are quite wonderful together.
I'm sure.
Well, the main challenge in writing the theatrical version of it was to create that linking material, you know, to take the wonderful material that Lois had found of their writings, and all of which is wildly entertaining, but then to be able to link it together in a way that created dialogue that works. So we have the principals, Twain and Shakespeare, and Mistress of Ceremonies, who serves as kind of narrator and the through thread of the piece. And then we have five other actors who will perform in the excerpts from Twain's and Shakespeare's writings, who will come downstage and take the parts of Adam and Eve or Huckleberry Finn or the Duke and the King from all
right.
of those bits.
Now, are there works of Mark Twain? I mean, there are certainly lesser known works. Are there unpublished works that you've found and brought in?
At this point, almost all of his work is being published by the University of California, Berkeley Press. There's a gazillion page autobiography that came out a couple of years ago that I'm sure nobody will read. I still like the Nita biography from 1952, though it's lacking in a lot of his dark work. So almost everything is out there. There are works we're using that he would not publish in his own lifetime. The 1601 conversation was something he wrote for a men's group. He would never have allowed language like that, nor would his family or public accepted it in the Victorian times.
Well, also The Mysterious Stranger,
yes.
which is towards the end of his career and one of his darker bits of philosophizing. There were three different attempts at that. He began it, abandoned it, began it again, tried it again, and then there was a third version, and that was published posthumously and sort of shuffled like a deck of cards in a
right.
way. It was put together by his literary executor in a way that he might not have and then, totally approved.
And then later in 1962, a version, all three versions came out, and the ending that his literary executive didn't like because it is so deeply and powerfully tragic and nihilistic was put back in.
So, of course, we've put it in, too.
And we're pairing it with Shakespeare's The Tempest, but we can't say why. It's one of the great revelations of the play.
Okay. Then we won't say why, ladies and gentlemen. But it is interesting. I mean, you talked about Mark Twain's moral sensibilities and his very honest writing about intervention and mm-hmm. military adventures and the kinds of things that people are still dealing with today.
And yes, absolutely. It has a lot of resonance for the contemporary moment.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's so interesting about reading Mark Twain is it doesn't feel as dated as you think it should.
Yep, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The area which does seem dated or which is a problem for modern audiences in both of them are all the stuff about the black slave Jim in Huckleberry Finn
right.
can seem offensive in certain readings to American audiences, to modern audiences, in the same way that Shakespeare's Shylock and Caliban
right.
Can seem not in tune with our 21st century cultural sensibilities. But if you look closely at what both writers were doing, they were working well outside the cultural frame of reference of their times to explore these characters who were much more the other in their day than they seem to us now, and made them, both writers, gave them a humanity that their contemporaries would not have thought of doing.
Right.
Yeah, I remember reading Huckleberry Finn in high school and then again in college, and thinking Jim was kind of the best character
he is.
In the whole book.
He is, but one of the reasons why Huckleberry Finn is the most banned work of literature in American schools, first when it was published, because it was thought that that Huck Finn was the worst role model for middle-class white boys anyone ever invented, and so libraries like the Concord Public Library in my home state of Massachusetts banned it, to which Mark Twain responded, "Thank you so much for not allowing my new novel in your library. Every library that bans my book sells 100 more copies."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like no publicity is ever,
exactly.
ever goes to waste.
But then starting in 1957, the NAACP began a series of suits against public schools that were teaching Huckleberry Finn. And many African-American parents for whose kids' only exposure to African-American slavery came through this novel in English classes were rightfully upset that this book contains a somewhat of seemingly Uncle Tom character, unless you read him more complexly. And more, even more than that, that the N-word is used, you know, so many times in the book that many of them said, our children feel humiliated when this is read out loud in class. And there's an incredible documentary that was made about this. One of the things that makes this actually quite contemporaneous is that it is still a subject of controversy in schools. And it doesn't have to be in schools that now have a plethora of African-American literature, teach slave narratives along with Huckleberry Finn. But for many years, it was students, black and white students and Latino students, only exposure to an African-American guy in a work of fiction.
Very interesting. And of course, the very fact that that was their only exposure was one of the many things that gave rise to a revision of school curricula.
Right. And there's an African-American writer who wrote a version of Huck Finn without the N-word, which I have to say makes me crazy. I would rather you either didn't teach it or you taught it the way it was written so students can have conversations about why this word was used.
And, I mean, historically, words change, and the meanings of words change, and the connotation of words change.
Right.
It's like, I couldn't believe it when they censored the new version of E.T.
Oh,
I don't even know about
that.
This.
Oh, well, subject for another conversation. Anyway, themes of God and Satan, themes of kind of a sense of darkness in their later work. Mm-hmm. That was what really fascinated me about
right.
this play. Both Shakespeare
yes.
and Twain were kind of ever revisiting these ideas, and their work got darker and darker as they got older.
Yeah.
Yes. It's not surprising, I don't think, that you know you would, after seeing the what has happened in the world in which you've lived, that and if you have a kind of attention span and interest in the human condition at large, which was true of both gentlemen, with the major exception that Mark Twain could not create a woman who was real to save his life. He just didn't try. He just barely ever dealt with women characters because he didn't want to deal with women's sexuality,
yeah.
except in these hidden works.
And he was a very protective father.
Very protective father.
Of his
daughters. Of his three daughters.
Yeah. So, okay, so this is, we're talking about the play Ever the Twain, William Shakespeare and Mark Twain's America by Lois Rudnick and Jonathan Richards, who are sitting here with us. It's one night only at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts on Sunday, the 31st of January. It's a benefit for KSFR, and there are still tickets available.
There are about 150 seats available at $10.
I know, it's dirt cheap.
A bargain.
At any price.
But you can also you can always buy a ticket and then contribute to KSFR on top of that.
Of course.
Excellent. Well, I would like to thank you both very much for being here with us on the Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing this play.
So do we.
Well, thank you. We look forward to having you there.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.